I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Andy Mahler. He first became involved in forest protection efforts in 1985 after encounters near southern Indiana. As president of Protect Our Woods, a local grassroots forest protection organization, he led efforts to protect the Hoosier from off-road vehicle trails, clear cuts, and oil and gas leasing. In 1991, he founded Heartwood, a cooperative regional forest protection network that used legal challenges and other means to stop logging on the national forests in the Heartland Hardwood region. In his community in Orange County, Indiana, Andy led efforts to start the Lost River Market and Deli, a member-owned natural foods grocery in Paoli, Indiana, and Orange County Homegrown, which operates a very popular local farmer's market. Andy hosts weekly music jams at both locations. He and his wife, Linda Lee, own a rustic and eclectic farm and lodge called the Lazy Black Bear, surrounded by the Hoosier National Forest on the rolling hills of southern Indiana, where they raise, rehabilitate, and release orphaned opossums and other critters. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. It's a pleasure to be here.
So can you talk about the region's forests? What are some of the main, like the forests here are, we could start with redwood and western red cedar and Doug fir. So if we were to talk about your region, what plants and animals would we start with?
Well, the most highly visible and charismatic of the forest species here, since most of the major mammal species have been extirpated, are the trees. And unfortunately, most of the oldest trees have been long since removed, but there are smaller tracts here and there of the original forest that were never subject to intensive logging by chainsaw, axe, or saw. And the biggest trees have remarkable character. They have personality. I have had the great pleasure of visiting western forests, and I know the power of those towering beings. Our landscape and our forest inhabitants, tree species, is a very different feel. Right now, we're in sort of our summer jungle season, although today is uncharacteristically low humidity. But people who travel out west and then return to, say, southern Indiana are often surprised by how much it feels like you're entering a jungle. And in fact, it is a jungle. It's a temperate jungle. And it's also, it has characteristics of rainforest. The main tree species, and here's something you should know, in Indiana, there are over 100 tree species. In the Hoosier National Forest, estimates certainly are that there are 70 various species of hardwoods, many different kinds of maples, many different kinds of hickories, many different kinds of oaks and so forth. And they speak of different forest types. And one of the types they speak of is the oak hickory forest. And that tends to grow on the drier south facing sites. And it is really a marvel to see these gigantic old white oaks. And white oaks, you know, once again, we don't have the longevity of some of the tree species along the Pacific coast, but a good oak on a good site can reach 600 years. And these are the oaks that, you know, that also grew and to some extent perhaps still grow in old Europe and in England, the trees that were well beloved of the Druids. What we have here in southern Indiana, and I should just say too that most people from either the east or the west regions of the country who've not spent any time in Indiana, or if they have spent time in Indiana, maybe have driven across the interstates. To most people, northern Indiana looks like an unending sequence of corn and soybean fields interrupted by urban centers in some degree of decay from the vast industrial heartland of the country, especially on I-80, I-90, I-70. But what happens is if you dip down into the lower third, and particularly the south central lower third, or lower ninth, if you will, what you'll find is unglaciated region of the state that's sitting to a significant extent on limestone soils, or limestone rock, bedrock. And then the soils have obviously formed over the years from the leaching of the limestone and the dropping of the deciduous trees. We have remarkable thunderstorms. I know people in the West, I think, are starting to get thunderstorms with lightning. I'm not sure. Anyway, that used to be a characteristic of our region, is these amazing thunderstorms with huge crashes of thunder and huge bolts of lightning, which helped shape the landscape. We've got oaks, hickories, beeches, maples, poplars, sycamore, sassafras, gum, sweet gum. We've got elm, ash, not so many ash anymore, unfortunately, due to the emerald ash borer. Virtually every ash tree in the forest has now gone. The Dutch elm disease took so many of the elms, and of course, the chestnut blight in the early part of the last century eliminated one of the most beautiful and useful of the original forest trees. But the trees around my home are growing to a significant extent on soils on top of limestone. And this limestone is truly remarkable. And this limestone is left over from the great inland sea. Limestone is laid down in shallow tropical waters. I remember a class I took in college where they showed a slide of a beautiful blue lagoon in the Bahamas somewhere. And he said, that's what makes the limestone like what we have here in southern Indiana. So Indiana is one of the limestone capitals of the world. They consider themselves the limestone capital. One other thing that happens with limestone is that the calcium carbonate is extremely, it's porous and it's subject to dissolution by moving water. We have about 44 to 48 inches of rain a year here in southern Indiana. And that water percolates down through the soil into the rock, and over thousands and thousands of years, it has created these remarkable cave networks in the rock. So one thing we have here in the forest of southern Indiana, and of course it's a deciduous forest, so we have unbelievable colors in the fall. And on a beautiful crystal clear day like today with the leaves changing in the deciduous forest, it is truly one of nature's most dramatic and beautiful displays is the fall color in these hardwood forests. But the thing about the cave systems through the rocks is that we have a system, it's called a karst system after a region, I believe, in Eastern Europe, that where the features were first described. But things like springs, rock faces, seeps, and other water features, including in here in Orange County where I live, the Lost River, a river that runs underground for 17 miles before reappearing further west in the county. So we have all this porous rock. We have springs here in southern Indiana that are some of the cleanest and most pure water anywhere in the eastern United States. And that is something very special and something, of course, well worth protecting in a time when water resources all around the planet are threatened. So the characteristics of this forest that I value most are the diversity and the clean and pure water. One thing that we have here in southern Indiana that I especially appreciate is that you can go into the forest and find a spring. This area around our home has been proposed for logging by the Forest Service, and they gave the area the name Buffalo Springs. Buffalo, because not far from where I sit, there's the old Buffalo Trace, which was the major travel way, first for, of course, migrating bison, as they made their way from their wintering foraging grounds in the bluegrass of Kentucky across the falls of the Ohio at what is now New Albany and Louisville. And then they would make their way across what is now Indiana on something that has become known as the Buffalo Trace, because they cleared a travel way. And it's not just one major corridor, of course, it's a woven, braided system. But the major travel way traveled was only about a mile and a half south of where I sit here. And that travel way became the major travel way for the indigenous peoples of the area, including the Shawnee, Piankashaw, Delaware, Miami. As they made their way across the area on foraging and hunting adventures. And then later the settlers and the pioneers used the Buffalo Trace. So between the Buffalo Trace and the many springs that characterize this area, both freshwater springs and mineral springs with heavy mineral content, including lithium and other metals that were considered medicinal, this area has remarkable water resources.
So I have a whole bunch of questions, and you can answer any or none or all. And one of them is, you mentioned in passing the effects that lightning had on the local ecology, and I'm used to lightning equating to fire, but I'm also used to that in the dry West. So that's one question, and I'm going to ask a whole bunch. This is a shotgun approach here. So one is, how did lightning affect the local land base? Another question is, how does the fact that river runs underground for 17 miles affect the local fish? Does that actually act as a barrier to the fish below and above? Third question, what are the effects of that incredibly clean water on mussels? Because I know that that's a big, big problem all over the eastern U.S., that mussels are generally very susceptible to dirty water. So do you have an abundance of clams, etc. there? Another question is, you mentioned buffalo. Can you talk a little bit about the megafauna? And another question is, you talked about chestnut blight, the ash having trouble, the elms having trouble. Are anybody surviving of those three locally, or are they completely faded? So those are a whole bunch of questions. You can take any, all, or none.
Well, let's start with the lightning, because I remember that one because it was the first one. And we have fairly substantial and reliable rainfall. Lightning, to the extent that it does cause fire, the fires tend to be highly localized. Of course, in the traditional landscape, there were beavers everywhere. Our forest is very wet. We get a lot of rain in the spring. The water is absorbed by the trees, and then the trees release that water through the drier months of summer. Now, it is possible, and I have no historical basis for conjecture here, but I think it's realistic to assume that sometime in a period of many thousands of years, there would be a multi-year drought where significant lightning storms might create stand replacing fires. But it is something that has not happened in recorded human history. While I think it is not improbable, it hasn't occurred in any place where I know that it has been documented. However, there have been fires, but most of the fires in this part of the country were fires that were anthropogenic, if you will, caused by humans after the clearing of the Great Forest. The forest itself was highly resistant to fire. Indigenous people did use fire to make and maintain relatively small clearings in the forest for settlement, but they did not do anything like the deliberate landscape scale fires that I've heard about in other parts of the country. There is no recorded history of that in this part of the country in terms of that scale. There might have been localized fire. As far as the bison, remind me of the bison.
Can you talk a little bit about various, see, this leads to another question. Can you talk about various megafauna who used to be there?
Yeah.
And then also, I know in one of our exchanges, and you mentioned caves, so can you also talk about bats?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Well, in terms of the megafauna, bison, I think, you know, the area, the French fur trappers and voyageurs were here in the 1600s and 1700s, maybe earlier even than that. The major European influx didn't come over the mountains until late 1700s, early 1800s. And of course, long before the settlers made it over the Appalachians, the diseases raced westward, as I'm sure you're familiar, from point of contact, tribe to tribe. And estimates I've seen are as high as 95%, a more realistic one, maybe 70% of the indigenous population, certainly portions of North America, if not the entire continent, were wiped out. Entire tribal groups were wiped out by some of these unfamiliar diseases as seemingly innocuous nowadays as the common cold or the flu. And I'm sure you know this, all of these Western European diseases that had no history, no analogs here in the what they called the New World. So major disease epidemic sweeping across the continent in advance, well in advance of the European settlers. So by the time the European settlers made it to this region, the area was largely depopulated. There were permanent settlements and there were major tribal groups, but not like the population that had been there 400 years before. But the major tribal groupings and the permanent settlements tended to be along riverways. So this part of the country where I am down here, we do not have the major riverways. We have lesser riverways, and they probably did have mussels in them. But the mussels, because of agriculture and land clearing and so forth, there are more probably mussel species on the endangered list in Indiana than any other organism. Followed soon thereafter, however, by bats that you also asked about. I'll get to the bats in a second. I just want to mention we had elk, bison, wolf, black bear, deer were even extirpated. Coyote were extirpated, as hard as that may seem be to believe. But both deer and coyote have made their way back. There have been several sightings of bear over the last 10 years. Bison are a little bit further off, but we're hoping through our work here to protect the forest and to protect the springs. We figure if we protect the forest, that will protect the springs. And if we protect the springs, the bison will eventually find their way back here. At least that's my fond hope, although I don't expect it to happen in my lifetime. But please, universe, surprise me. As far as bats, Derek, I don't even know how to describe the bat diversity we have here in southern Indiana with all these remarkable caves. And regarding the caves and the waterways, yes, the underground water is an impediment for most of the species. So I don't have direct firsthand knowledge. This is my best guess based on what I do know, is that it would be very difficult for me to imagine the fish upstream of the underground river being connected to the fish downstream from the underground river. One thing we do have in the underground river system is species unknown previously to science anywhere else on planet Earth. You know, there are analogs elsewhere, but we have unique cave species here in south central Indiana that exist nowhere else on Earth. So that's what leads me to believe that probably there's not any migration from upstream to below on a lot of these cave systems. Maybe the biggest one, yes, but the smaller ones, no. As far as bats, we have 40 species of bats in Myotis here in Indiana, and many of them are critically endangered. You know about forest plans for national forests. Well, the forest plan for the Hoosier National Forest came out in 2006, and they're supposed to be revised no later than every 15 years, and obviously we're in 17 years of a 15, what's supposed to have been a 15-year plan. Well, the reality is that one thing that happened in 2006 that the forest conveniently neglects to evaluate and analyze in their proposals for the timber sales is that white-nosed syndrome was first documented in New York State in 2006, and of course it eventually made its way here to Indiana. And at least three species have had their populations decline by 95%. Northern long-eared bat, tricolor, I believe, Indiana bat, all of those are critically endangered. Indiana bat was actually one of the very first species on the endangered species list when that act was first passed. But it's been catastrophic what has happened to bat populations here in southern Indiana. Now, obviously, Forest Service logging cannot be blamed for those population declines, but Forest Service logging certainly contributes to the perpetuation of those declines and slows whatever recovery the bats might be capable of fomenting. So we are looking at, since I have lived here in southern Indiana, I moved here from Bloomington, which is also southern Indiana, but since I've been in Orange County, I got here in July of 1979, we used to see bats flying around at night, every night, and it was such a wonderful thing because in the forests of the Lake States and the forests of the Deep South, you go out in the summertime, you're going to get bit by mosquitoes. The forests of Indiana in the summertime, we never saw a mosquito. Unfortunately, that has changed as bat populations have plummeted. I can't tell you how many nights I've had the window open after reading, you know, dark outside, light inside with maybe a little book light, turn out the book light, open the window because I like the cool breeze to come in, and had bats in our bedroom flitting around our head while we slept. I actually, on three separate occasions, and this is a little surprising, had bats land on me. And you don't really, you think, I mean, bats with their sonar, surely they know exactly where I am. Why is this bat landing on me? As much as I love the music of the bats around the bedroom, landing on me was a little bit startling, but not to where I jumped up or anything, but it did take me by surprise. But one of the great tragedies of the past several decades is the significant decline in bat populations. But we do still have bats, but bats are a major issue.
So eventually I want to get to the Forest Service logging program, but before then I also want to, so the issue of bats makes me want to ask about insects, that how are, can you talk a little bit, I don't think insects get enough attention when people talk about biomes, and can you talk a little bit about the insect diversity where you live?
Oh, I couldn't agree more, Derek, and it's one of the issues I raise consistently, especially pollinators. You know, bats are themselves pollinators, but insects, there has been a pronounced, significant, and highly noticeable, for anybody who's paying attention, decline in both in insect total populations and in insect diversity, and with a particular focus on the pollinators like the solitary bees, of which there are numerous species. Now, once again, this is not my area of expertise, but I am fortunate to be in regular contact with people who know their bats, know their pollinators, know their forest floor vegetation, know the various components of the streams, the sky, and the treetops. And we are seeing pronounced declines in insects in southern Indiana, with one noteworthy exception, of course, and that is the ticks that are following global warming northward. We have several more species of ticks that we never had when I first got here, and they carry a whole host of new and unfamiliar diseases. One called ehrlichiosis almost killed a dear friend of mine, almost killed one of our dogs. Fortunately, there's a readily available antibiotic, doxycycline, that works very remarkably and effectively against it. There's another disease, which my wife Linda has, called Alpha Gal, which is also her superpower name. But she, it means that people who are affected by the ticks that carry this Alpha Gal become allergic to mammal meat. And now that's not necessarily a bad thing on a planet where mammals are contributing to a lot, you know, the domesticated livestock are contributing to significant ecological catastrophes around the planet. So not necessarily a bad thing that people would eat, consume less mammal meat, but nonetheless, it does include such things as squirrel and deer and other wild animal meats that can be taken in such a way that you don't diminish the well-being and the survival of the entire species.
So there's two things that you just brought up here that I want to ask about. One of them is, I think squirrels are squirrels don't get enough credit, I think, for, and I hate to use this word, but engineers of the forest. And do you want to talk about the role squirrels play?
Absolutely, Derek.
And then the other question I want to ask is, and this one I really want you to get to, is I have lived my entire life in the West, which are primarily coniferous forests, which
right.
means I've not thought extensively about who lives in deciduous forest litter.
Uh-huh.
So can you talk about how the leaves get converted into soil and who lives down there?
Yeah. Well, first the squirrels, and the squirrels just do remarkable work. You know, I don't have the numbers, but squirrels have been the best friends the oaks have had, for instance. They take these viable acorns from this great diversity of oak species that we have here, and they bury thousands of them. And then maybe a squirrel gets killed. Maybe it doesn't need every seed that's buried. But these acorns are buried deeper in the litter than the superficial seeds of the maples and other windborne seeds. And they are there waiting for the opportunity to express themselves whenever there is an opening in the forest. And the squirrels contribute to there always being a source of regeneration for oaks and other nut-bearing trees favored by squirrels. I don't know if the squirrels buried chestnuts, but chestnuts, as I mentioned, were a species that was extirpated. The native North American chestnut is virtually gone. There's still some stands in Florida and Michigan that where the blight has not reached yet. But there's two issues that come up with chestnuts. One is they've been doing back crossing, trying to get a 15/16 chestnut with disease resistance. And unfortunately, the trials have not yielded very favorable results. The other edge of this sword is genetically engineered chestnuts. And there's a major push out now to try and restore chestnuts through genetically engineered trees. And obviously, that is a whole other issue that we can delve into if we want, but that might take us the rest of the conversation. Back to the forest floor, the fungal diversity in these woods is unreal. And we recently had a couple of young people. We live next to the National Forest, and at the top of the hill near our home, there's the Young's Creek Horse Camp. And we often stop up there and talk to the people at the camp and tell them about our little member-owned food co-op in town and tell them over the last year and a half what the Forest Service has proposed for this area. But this young couple from Washington State, they were both mycologists, and they had been we thought they were just doing it on their own initiative, but apparently they'd been hired by a pharmaceutical company to try and collect fungal diversity in relatively undisturbed eastern hardwood forests. And they shared with me something that surprised me, and that is that two mushrooms from the same species can have very different DNA sequences. And so they were looking for these unique DNA sequences to, because this company was looking for a cancer cure. So we have the soil is the forest. You know this. I know that was the basic intent of your question. You don't have whatever grows above the soil without the health and diversity of the soil itself. And that soil health and diversity is based on this incredibly intricate and complex series of chemical and electrical interactions between billions of individuals of millions of different species that inhabit the soils of our region. I think most soils are that diverse, but I do know that our soils have incredible diversity of bacteria and fungi and proteins and various unicellular organisms and digesters and composters. And once again, it's almost better to get a poet than a taxonomist to describe what's happening in the forest soils. But that is something that just befuddles me, that they completely ignore soil health in their attempts to manipulate the products of that soil in the form of trees. One of the things that we have here is some places we have these incredibly deep, rich soils. And this reminds me of a tangent, and I apologize for going off, but it does bear retelling. And that was the little town of Millersburg, Indiana, when Linda and I used to drive east and west, north and south on organizing trips, and we were getting hardwood going. One time we got off the blue highways and got off on county roads and went to this little town of Millersburg, where there was one house left and everything else was boarded up or fallen down with lots of anti-Peabody coal graffiti. And the last guy in the last house there at the edge of Millersburg, there was a sign that said, Millersburg, population 4 and 1 dog. And so we stopped and talked to this guy and found that he was actually an equipment operator for the coal company, but he was holding out to get his price before he would sell to Peabody, which at the time was owned by some conglomerate from Great Britain. And what he told me, and this is related to what we were talking about a second ago, and that is that there were 17 feet of topsoil on this land that they were proposing to strip mine. 17 feet of some of the richest topsoil on planet Earth was not enough to protect this land from the ravages of the coal industry. So anyway, back to what we were talking about before is the soil. Well, where does 17 feet of topsoil come from? It comes from this incredibly healthy, diverse forest, living, reaching full maturity, going through the process of senescence and decay and death, falling to the forest floor, decomposing, reconstituting, and growing over and over again, dropping thousands of tons of leaves every year and creating this incredibly diverse, rich soils that produces everything you see above above the surface.
Thank you for that. A question I asked earlier that we didn't get to is, are the ash and, you said chestnut has been extirpated locally. Are the ash and elm completely extirpated locally, or are there any left?
There are elm left. There are elm left, whether they are going to eventually succumb or whether there's enough disease resistance now in the remaining stems, I couldn't say. I'm hopeful that they will find their place back into the forest. They are still here. One thing, I don't know if the area where you are has morel mushrooms. I know they're found in many places in North America, but we have amazing morels here in as part of our mushroom diversity here in South Central Indiana. And you know, every mushroom hunter has his or her own secrets and their his or her own special locations. But one thing that everybody recognizes is that there's no better indicator of where to find an amazing flush of morel mushrooms than under an elm tree in the year, a dying elm tree in the year when it sloughs its bark. If you see an elm tree that has just sloughed its bark, if you get out there during mushroom season, there's a very high likelihood you will find a good number of beautiful honey-colored morel mushrooms. Anyway, so the elms are still persisting. I do not know their long-term fate. The ash right now, I hear there are some ash trees that have demonstrated some degree of resistance to the borers, but I've not seen them. From here to this area that I am more familiar with than I am literally the back of my hand, every elm of any size has died. Now, will the young elm, I'm sorry, ash, every ash of any size has died. And ash happens to be one of my very favorite trees because they just have so much personality. But they're gone. Now, there is a realistic possibility and a hope that they have not succumbed to a disease like the chestnut, but to the predations of a predator, an insect called the emerald ash borer. And once the emerald ash borer has taken out all the big ashes, there's a good chance their populations will, of course, plummet or move on to other parts of the country where there are still ash trees. And there is a decent chance that the ashes will recover, but not in any time frame meaningful to a guy of my advanced years or even to younger folk, because it could take a good long while. Now, there is an exception to that, and that is at least 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago now, there was something called dogwood anthracnose that came through our forest. This was fairly early on in my career as an activist. And I don't know if you're familiar with the dogwood tree. It's a mid-story tree. It's a beautiful, delightful tree. It's some of the hardest wood of any tree in the forest. In fact, early loggers would make wedges out of dogwood wood in order to use those wedges in felling larger trees. It was great for maul heads and so forth. Very hard, dense wood. Anyway, the thing about dogwoods is they have the most exquisitely beautiful white, slightly creamy colored white flower in the spring with just a little dot of red in the middle of the flower. The dogwood is revered too because it's one of the few trees that has opposite branches. The ash happens to be another one. But the little cross-shaped flower with the little dot of red was revered by Christians. And there is this story that the dogwood tree was the tree from which the wood for the cross that Christ was nailed to was fabricated. And because of that, whatever powers might be decided that the dogwood should never grow big enough to produce wood sufficient for a cross again. And so that's why the dogwood's a mid-story tree. You can take that for what it's worth, but it is a revered tree because its flowering in the spring is comparable to the azaleas in the Appalachians or, you know, the laurel, just these amazing fluorescences of great beauty that reminds you of nature's return and the joy and wonder of spring. So anyway, dogwoods all died from anthracnose back in the probably early 80s, maybe. And some of these trees were, you know, you could have a dogwood tree 10 inches or more in diameter. They didn't get, you know, 20 inches, 24 inches, but you could have some big, beautiful dogwood trees, and they all died. Well, the good news I'm trying to get around to is that the dogwoods are back. They're not the big trees, but dogwoods are back in the hardwood forest of southern Indiana, and we're seeing them flowering again. We saw them last spring. We saw even more of them this spring, and so I have great hope that the dogwoods have staged a comeback, and perhaps the ash and the elm will as well.
So one of the reasons, apart from just hearing all these wonderful stories, one of the reasons that I wanted to specifically interview you now has to do with a logging plan that is out. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I can. And let me just preface that with, thank you for reading that bio earlier. I spent, close to two decades as a full-time forest protection activist. And at the end of that period, we had literally shut down all logging in the national forests of the hardwood region, which include Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Missouri, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and so forth. We had, through litigation, we knew the law and the regulations better than the Forest Service did, and we nailed them on one thing in particular, but many others as well, and that was their failure to adequately protect habitat for the Indiana bat. So that, and there are two people in particular whose names should be mentioned, that's Jim Bensman and Mark Donham, and who did amazing work preparing the cases to where eventually we found lawyers who were willing to take the cases. And with Mark and Jim's great legwork and the great legal help we had, we were literally able to shut down logging across our entire hardwood region. But one of our cases in particular, having to do with Forest Service's inappropriate and illegal use of categorical exclusions, actually shut down every logging operation in the entire country that was based on a categorical exclusion. So, or like any logging operation of any significant size. Let's see, where was I going with that? Okay, so anyway, I was a forest activist for close to two decades. And then I thought, what would it be like if I spent as much of my time and precious energy as I get older trying to create a more livable world rather than trying to stop bad stuff? I feel that in life there are three critical things that each human being has to engage with on some level or other, and that is stopping bad stuff, creating good stuff, and finding the sources of power that make the other two possible, finding the sources of internal strength, but also exterior organizing, being able to manifest power in a way that can actually influence the outcome of these political decisions. So then I helped start this group called Orange County Homegrown that built this beautiful farmer's market and did put murals on walls and so forth. And then out of that grew this thing called Lost River Market Deli, a member-owned natural foods co-op. And then Linda had two terrible falls, 7 years apart. We slept outside there every night, outside, in the weather, under a roof, mind you, but no railing, no windows, no screens, for more than 20 years, outside every night for more than 20 years. I cannot tell you what an enriching experience that was, up until the point when one night in a confused state, Linda wandered off, because this is a second floor porch, mind you, Linda wandered off the porch and landed on the rocks below. So that totally changed my entire life, needless to say. I got off every board of directors I was on. I was no longer a full-time activist on forest, but I was still a community activist and organizer. I stopped all of that except for playing music. I still wanted to organize public music events where it wasn't a performance, but it was a participation, where people would sit in a circle and take turns playing a tune. So that was my activism. And then Linda fell a second time. We put up a railing. We thought we had everything secured. There was no way she could get through this railing. Another confused state one night, she fell a second time. And so I still played music, but I figured I was going to dedicate the rest of my life to enjoying my time with Linda as much time as possible, that we were going to spend as much quality time together doing the things that we love to do. And then the other thing I was going to do with the rest of my life, knowing that the forest I knew and loved was dying before my eyes, I wanted to sit hospice with the forest. I used to love to explore the forest, but this period was what I call insploring, where you take the familiar and get to know it even better. And I cannot tell you how enriching that is, to take something you think you already know and get to know it better. Talk about the wisdom that comes with advanced years. So that's what I was doing with my life when the forest released this new proposal. I was spending as much time walking in the woods as possible and spending every opportunity drinking fresh water from one of these remarkable springs.
So,
and
before,
then the rest of my time I was spending with Linda.
So before we
and
go on.
And then the Forest Service dropped this proposal. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Derek.
Okay, no, it's great. But before we go on about that, I just want to – can you give us like three sentences on what it's like to walk through like perhaps the same place in the forest and how you see different things every day? Because I do this myself and it's extraordinary. I was just yesterday, I was walking down this little game trail and thinking, wow, how different this game trail is than it was 10 years ago. Can you just talk about the beauty of seeing the same place?
15 minutes ago sometimes. Yeah, no, I mean, that is the wonderful thing. Derek, I've had this experience where by walking from, you know, if you know where you're going when you're walking in the woods, you're denying yourself 90% of the benefit of walking in the woods. It's better to walk in the woods without a destination, hopefully knowing enough about the woods to be able to find your way back out again, of course, and I've had my experiences in that regard as well. But where I have walked into a place, and, you know, if it's a gray day, and I don't generally carry a compass because I don't mind getting lost from time to time. That's one of the great joys of living next to a wild place that you know well, is when you approach it from a different direction, you can come to some places from there. I got to a place that was actually on our own land, and I thought I'd discovered something never before seen by humankind. Obviously, this is an extreme exaggeration, but just approaching someplace familiar from a different vantage or in a different season, a different meteorological condition, or a different weather pattern. And this is crazy, I know, but one thing I used to like to do when it was snowing is I'd go out just beyond where I knew exactly where I was to where I wasn't sure where I was when it was snowing at night, and I would spin around till I got dizzy, and then I would open my eyes and try and find my way home. So I love exploring the woods, and there is this little panic that sets in when you think, oh my God, I really blew it this time. I have no idea where I am, but I'll tell you what, there's a great joy and satisfaction and feeling of accomplishment just to find your way home under some circumstances.
So we only have like 5 minutes left. Can you, this has been really fun. Thank you so much. Can you tell us very quickly about this timber sale project?
Yeah, so it's called Buffalo Springs, Buffalo after the Buffalo Trace, Springs after this recreational and tourism destination area near here called Springs Valley, which is the major resort towns of French Lick and West Baden. And I encourage your listeners to check out the West Baden Springs Hotel on the internet. It's an amazing architectural wonder, absolutely unique, one of a kind. It just happens to be here in South Central Indiana in Orange County. So anyway, this Buffalo Springs proposal, they dropped it in October of 2021, just a few days before Linda's and my 40th wedding anniversary, and you can imagine how much that added to our sense of celebration. So it sat on the table for 3 days. I didn't know what was in there, and after I opened it, I wished I'd let it sit a bit longer because my life was turned upside down. We live right next to the Youngs Creek Horse Trail and the Youngs Creek Campground. It's a 13-mile trail, and they're proposing to convert 8 miles of that 13-mile trail to logging road that would be closed to the public for the duration of the logging, and the logging can go on for up to 15 years. The logging includes over 5,000 acres of logging, the largest such proposal in the history of the Hoosier National Forest. I know 5,000-acre logging operation is not big by Western standards, but in a small national forest of 200,000 acres, a little over 200,000 acres, a 5,000-acre logging proposal is huge, and of that, over 1,300 acres was going to be clear-cut. They wanted to spray herbicide on 800 acres of the forest in the cleanest watershed in the state of Indiana, and they wanted to burn 15,000 acres repeatedly as often as every 3 years for up to 25 years in one of the wettest, most fire-resistant forests in the country. They wanted to convert it into a fire-adapted forest. And one interesting component of this plan is that 5,000 acres of the 15,000 acres they're proposing to burn are among the privately owned land in the Hoosier National Forest. And I don't think we have time to go into the ownership patterns here on the Hoosier, but suffice it to say that within the purchase area of the Hoosier, more than two-thirds of the land is actually privately owned. So it's really small and significantly fragmented forest ownership. So among that land that they wanted to burn was our 30 acres of our land, obviously with our permission only, of course, but that's how desperate they are to spend these fire dollars that Congress has given them, that they are burning every forest in the country under whatever pretext rather than send any of that money back to the Congress, since they can't possibly spend it all out west, no matter how many thousands and thousands of dollars worth of flame retardant they pour into your pristine riverways out there.
Hey, anyway, I got an idea. Let's spend it instead on, how about bat preservation? Or how about, road removal?
Or taking out roads, or buying up privately owned land that has been heavily degraded, and do whatever, you know, managerial restoration work they have been trained to do. I can respect that on this privately owned land that is now being acquired for inclusion in the national forest and consolidating the ownership around the Hoosier. So anyway, with this major proposal for the Hoosier, that was the end of my walking in the woods, because it's hard to walk in the woods knowing you're going to possibly be seeing these trees for the last time, when you could be instead organizing to try and protect them for at least the rest of your life, and hopefully for the next several centuries, which is my intention, is that we are going, you know, as, when we formed our group, one thing that is really remarkable, and, you know, I don't take credit for it, but it's the reality, is I had a lot of experience dealing with the Forest Service. You know, and it was hard-earned knowledge, and I was able to take our young group, many of whom were new to the issue, not many people still around from our previous go-round, although we revived the organization we started back in 1985, Protect Our Woods, but we decided collectively, fairly early on, at my urging, that our policy would be not one inch, not one tree. You know, other people can make deals if they need to, but our intention is to protect every inch of forest and protect every tree from logging and other forms of exploitation and degradation. And we have been able to this is the amazing thing, Derek. You know, when we did this 30 years ago, we were just sort of these wild weirdos in the woods who thought a tree should never be cut. Well, guess what? Now, without changing our position at all, we now have support from the county commissioners of Orange County, three Trump supporting Republicans. We have the unanimous support of the Crawford County commissioners, two Trump supporting Republicans and one Trump opposing Republican. We've got support from other counties around the state, but we've got the support of the Orange County Farm Bureau. We have got the support of the Paoli Chamber of Commerce. We have got the support of the Orange County Economic Development Partnership. We have got the support of the Crawford County Economic Development Corporation. It is unbelievable how much support we have for our stated intention to protect the entire forest.
So we're sadly running out of time in more ways than one. And can you say how people can support your efforts, support specifically your efforts, and more broadly, how people can oppose this logging plan?
Well, if people would like to learn more, we've got two Facebook groups, one called Protect Our Woods, one called Save Hoosier National Forest. We've got a fairly rudimentary website called SaveHoosierNationalForest.com, but we are hoping to upgrade that and make it much more interactive and much more user-friendly in the next few weeks, because now we're able to actually turn our attention from just doing whatever we can think of to stop the Forest Service to actually trying to promote our positive alternative vision, which we call the Citizens' Preferred Alternative, which calls for protecting water quality and so forth. I won't go into details because it's more important that I tell your listeners how they can help. So you can go on the website and give us an email address if you'd like to be kept apprised. But if you're willing to take one action right now, I would ask you to please contact Gina Owens, who is the regional forester for this region, based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's Gina.Owens, G-I-N-A dot O-W-E-N-S, at usda.gov. Introduce yourself to Gina and tell her why you think public forests should be protected. And if you care to mention Buffalo Springs, please urge her to do whatever she can to protect Buffalo Springs. We believe that Gina is in a position to help change the management plan for Buffalo Springs. And if she's able to change the management plan for Buffalo Springs, she can change the management plan for the entire Hoosier National Forest. And being in the position she's in, if she is willing and able to change the management plan for the Hoosier National Forest, she can also change the direction, the managerial focus, and the vision for the Shawnee National Forest in Illinois and the Wayne National Forest in Ohio, and so on, and keep growing from there as we re-envision the purpose of these publicly owned lands in the East and in the West, because if we are successful in the East, it should redound to every national forest in the system. And the reason I know this, Derek, is because we did it once before. Things that we did here in southern Indiana back in the 1980s actually made things better for forest protection activists across the country, and we intend to do that again by setting a new standard and a new model for forest protection, starting with Buffalo Springs and then the Hoosier National Forest and then as many of the forests in the hardwood region as we can. Our friends and colleagues in Illinois are calling for that land to be transferred from the USDA Forest Service to the Department of Interior Park Service. And if we are not able to work with the Forest Service, we're prepared to take that action. As we told Undersecretary of Agriculture, Dr. Homer Wilkes, when he visited our county twice, mind you, but on the second time at the invitation of Senator Mike Braun, we said to him at the public meeting that had over 300 people in attendance, we said, the Hoosier National Forest is going to be protected. It's either going to be protected by the Forest Service or it's going to be protected from the forest.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for all your work in the world, and thank you for taking that not one tree, not one inch approach, which, of course, I agree with 100%, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Andy Mahler. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.